So on this rare occasion, I will introduce us sitting down. Usually I'm standing up to introduce our speakers, but I get to do so because I'm reclining in luxury here, relatively speaking. Stuart and I both studied with the same teacher for many years. I from 1977 through 1998, Stuart through 1985 through 1998. And along the way, the subject of tonight's talk has been something that our teacher and many other teachers that we've met along the way have been have offered teachings about. So tonight, we look at the latest research. Stuart Gudnick is, in addition to being one of the co-directors of Tuggy Meditation Center, one of the co-founders of this store, is also a, what would you call yourself? A staff member. What does that mean? A staff member.
A middle manager.
There we go. A middle manager in a Fortune 500 company. He plays the shakuhachi exceedingly well. And I have been an archaeologist. In fact, I'm now writing for the first time in quite a while. I'm writing a piece for a new archaeology book coming out, and sort of getting my hand, really the tip of my finger back in again. And I'm one of the co-founders of Many Rivers. So voila.
Here voila. We are.
Join me in welcoming us. There you go. All right, Stuart, you're up.
Well, the way these talks usually unfold is that Rob said, we're going to do a talk on this date, so now we need to write a blurb for it.
We're going to go into the whole history here.
Yeah, well, anyway. No, it's a short history. But it's relevant to the topic at hand because, you know, the way to approach the problem is, well, so let's get quiet and see what pops up. And this question of free will was the first thing that came up.
Is that because I told you we were going to do this on this
day?
Yeah,
so I was enslaved by your order.
Exactly. Okay, fair enough.
And but the question of free will kind of popped up in that void, and it certainly is a subject that I find challenging, endlessly fascinating, and a really great inquiry or a gateway to deeper inquiry, because contained within the whole question, if you don't get too, you know, philosophically erudite about it, are some very immediate practical questions that impact how we conduct ourselves in on a spiritual path or in a spiritual practice. And so that's what we want to explore tonight. We want to, you know, touch on the subject and really look at a lot of different sides of it, because there are lots of different perspectives we can take on this question. Where I'll start is something that I find fairly provocative now, and it's a challenge that we have to answer if we're going to approach, you know, the facts of our lives with our with the direct experience of our being. And that's that science is telling us some interesting stories about how what we take to be choice and what we take to be will or motivation may not be everything that it seems. Some of the most classic research that's been done in recent years as the tools for neurological analysis become much sharper is to show that you can show that in the brain and in the nerves and the muscles that there are anticipatory activities significantly earlier in time than we have the awareness that we are going to do something. So for instance, if I feel like I'm going to move my hand and you look at the data that you look at the what's going on neurologically, you can see in some studies there's like 350 millisecond anticipation. Other studies have shown as much as 10 seconds. Right. So when you think about that, I mean, and these are not uncommon research. There's quite a lot of research that shows this kind of behavior, and you see it in humans. It's harder. You can't really. You can see the same patterns in animals. You can't really tell, since we don't have a way of inquiring their subjective experience. We can't really tell much. But with a human, this thing, this sense we have of I'm going to make a choice, seems, at least at the neurobiological level, to have antecedents that, or as the Buddhists would say, causes and conditions that proceed much earlier in time than we have the awareness of any notion of intentionality. And that's to me, that's a very stark and shocking claim. Scientifically minded people, the new atheists who some of you may have read about, will often use those results to, you know, make more blanket statements like there is no free will, there's not, you know, that free will is completely an illusion. Some people go further in that regard and you know, use that to support a notion that what we take as consciousness is what they call an epiphenomenon, or a consequential illusion that's riding on top of a complex series of biological activity, and that the sense we have of autonomous existence and the sense we have of any sort of authorship over our actions is completely illusory. So that's kind of the extreme of that position. And to me, that the facts that are being measured in the laboratory do demand a response of some sort from in the context of spiritual inquiry, because it really is a it's just like practical spiritual work needs to look facts in the face and ask what does that mean, or what is that telling me about the nature of my experience. So that's the starting point for this inquiry. You know, that I'm starting it with kind of the challenge or the gauntlet that's been thrown down by modern science, and want you to think about that for a moment. Because if I can show you in the lab, if I could show you, you know, hook you up to a machine and demonstrate that prior to you having a conscious awareness of an intention, that there's a trace of that intention already being formulated within your system, then that suggests that...
or a trace of that action, particularly.
But that suggests then that we are ourselves, our story of authorship, our story of free will, is a narrative that's constructed after the fact rather than a objective reality that is driving activity. So that's the challenge. What you?
Fine.
You can say something now.
I see a question.
Yeah, please.
What are the antecedents?
The antecedents in this case, the antecedents are things like I believe they are either neural activity in the centers of the brain that are associated with. Like muscle action, like for instance, there's specific areas, like if I'm moving my arm, or there's centers of activity probably on the opposite side of the body here, but so there's regions that have been mapped out, so they can, so that's in one case, that's what you see activity, like that part of the brain starts to get active, and activation probably means something very specific, like the rate of firing of nerve cells. In other cases, I'm not. That's the one I'm aware of. So I think there's some other possible cases as well. I think there. In some cases, you can see things like changes of galvanic skin resistance, and just all sorts of physiological measurements that indicate the body is already preparing for something.
I thought when you used the word antecedents, you meant. I was looking for this really. As esoteric answer. I mean,
well,
I thought it meant that this activity had its roots in something totally other than the neurological reactions, responses, activity.
Well, I think that, I mean, that, I think that's a reasonable question as to, you know, the, in the way I would formulate that question, you know, in terms of, to spring from what I was saying is, are there other antecedents that may be causal in the arising of either an action I take or the feeling I have that I am taking an action? And I'm making a distinction here because those are two separate questions. But does that get kind of like to what the question is you're asking? Or are you asking for something larger? We'll get to that toward the end of the talk. I don't want to go there just yet.
So the brain is driving it?
What I'm saying is
that we're unaware of that.
Yes. So in other words,
actually, the whole body is participating in creating an action, essentially, before we have any conscious awareness of that of that happening.
Kim.
And that still couldn't be part of free will.
Well, that's the question. All I'm saying at this point is that.
There's physiological responses before we're aware of a conscious decision.
Yes.
I'm still thinking it could be part of free will.
So that's a reasonable hypothesis, but then we have to and we'll get into that a little bit more, because all I'm saying at this point is that more materialistically minded people take the facts that I just presented and draw a conclusion, which is that free will is illusory, and that our conscious experience is a narrative that's constructed by the egoic system after the fact of deterministic behaviors that are caused by a myriad of other sorts of preceding causes and conditions.
Did you have a question,
sir? I thought it would be helpful to give just a really quick summary of what the experiment was. What kind of decisions are we took? Obviously, there people are in an MRI machine.
I think in some cases, yeah, there's fMRI experiments, which are the functional magnetic resonance measurement. Yeah, imagery. Thank you.
EEG as well, is it, if I'm not mistaken?
Yeah, the one I was just looking at before the talk was reported. I think it was fMRI, but basically, so you basically you're able to see fairly detailed activities in the brain.
Not my question. What are they asking you to do? What are they asking you to choose?
Lift your arm. It's something simple,
timing
like
timing of when I decide to lift my arm or not.
Yeah, I think it's I think they're asking people to report, you know, like to like say make a motion or something like that. Tell me when you're, you know, you tell me. You're the first person laboratory, or you tell me when you think you're aware of deciding to make a motion, and then when you look at the time stream before and after the reported experience of intentionality, there is a distinct signature. And so does that answers the question?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm using a simple example. I didn't go through an exhaustive study of a lot of different cases, but there's the 350 millisecond number, and the 10 second ones are the, kind of the ones that have been talked about a lot in recent books and things like that.
You had a question?
Yeah, there's three observations kind of along this line that I immediately thought of when we were talking. Back in the 1940s, I think it was, there was a researcher who was studying biological energy, and he was looking at amoebas under the microscope. And he found that with the amoebas, before they started to move, the side of their body previous to movement would illuminate. It would start to glow.
Mm.
And then the pseudopod would come out, and it would reach out. And then another study he did was of mealworms, and he observed the autonomic, nervous system in the mealworms, and found that it was expanded and contracted, and that it was like a living plasma, and not just circuitry, you know, that we often think of it, but it was actually this kind of moving, living, plasmatic. And then the other thing, more recently, was a person was doing experiments with a very sensitive millivolt meter, and he was lecturing, and he was gesturing, and the meter was set up over here, prepared for another experiment. But when he was speaking and gesturing, the millivolt meter would register before his hand went over towards it.
Mm-hmm.
It would anticipate. So there seems to be possibly some energetic function that ties and informs and perhaps conveys information between the brain and this pulsatile autonomic nervous system that doesn't keep them separate, but they're very much, you know, tied in. And it's the energetic function that is maybe preceding.
Yeah, I got it. And I think there's that's a reasonable hypothesis, and there's a lot of suggestive research along those lines. Mm-hmm. The challenge with the amoeba and the mealworm is we can't interrogate them as to when they feel something is, you know, happening.
You can stimulate them with,
yeah,
you know, little.
You can stimulate them and see a reaction.
Right, and with the amoeba, it was always that illumination occurred before the pseudopod. So there was a reaching out.
Yeah, so the more interesting question would be, is there does the illumination occur at the site of the excitation prior to the administration of the stimulus?
But there was no stimulus. It was just the observation of,
okay,
of the,
yeah, in that case.
Yeah, there was no stimulus,
right,
at that point.
And I don't, I just threw something out there. It's sort of secondary to the topic of this talk, but there is a class of parapsychological research that actually does demonstrate statistically significant, although small, effects that show an anticipation in the nervous system to a future event, and that future event is randomly generated, and yet there seems to be a correlation between the response to the action. The event.
Really?
Can I just say, in those experiments, which were done by Robert John, I believe, a friend of mine, he worked with him, and they found they got an even higher response when there was an emotional content to whatever the action or the thought or the command was.
Mm.
So the emotionality just amped it up completely, way beyond any of the smaller statistical.
Interesting. Yeah, and actually the research I was referring to is research that Dean Radin has done at IONS. Robert John's research was, I don't know if he did the presentiment research, he did a lot of psychokinetic research. But, you know, all of these are good points. I want to get back to the issue of free will, because, even with what we've been talking about with the flow and the energetic flow of the body, and it's clear that what we do and what actions we take have causes and conditions. There are things that come up that give rise to the doings, the actions that we take. As you look at it from a more, interior perspective, the thoughts that arise or even the feelings that we have also have causes and conditions. And the question at hand is whether the narrative and the experience we have of being the author of our actions is a cause or whether it's an effect.
Mm-hmm.
And that's I'm framing it that way because it's an interesting challenge. Mm-hmm. Because there may be all these connections we have, and there may be all these we live within an energetic matrix. We are also encultured in our lives. We're raised. We're given certain ideas. We have dispositions and viewpoints on the world, and those viewpoints give rise to feelings, and those feelings give rise to responses.
And all of those feelings and responses are parts of processes that are not not as bounded as we may be accustomed to think.
Right. And yet, there's this sense that I can do things, and I can impact things, and I can control my destiny. And the
I am a captain.
Yeah.
My soul.
And so that's so you know, I'm kind of returning to the theme here. This is sort of the refrain of this talk. Is the question at hand is that sense of the I who is in control, a narrative constructed after the fact, that's riding on top of a myriad of processes, which may exist at very material levels and may exist at very spiritual levels. Nonetheless, the story we tell of ourselves, the feeling of the story we have of ourselves as being autonomous and in control may be an illusion.
I remember when the term future cause was introduced to me,
mm-hmm.
and I loved it. Something clicked inside of me, and I moved a little bit closer to becoming integrated. And I learned also that there are some critters that, like a week before an earthquake strikes, their hair will stand up on its ends. And there is always this sense of calling, of being called forward. And so much has to do with our sense of the movement of time. And we're so enculturated with the idea that time moves from the past to the future, that we're almost dragged back by that notion. And there's an actual freedom for me in seeing the reverse of that, that time actually moves from the future towards in the direction of the past, but there's a kind of a dance, that's right. The future and the past are eternity's lovers. The present is their embrace, and destiny is their child. I like that
it kind of ties together this notion of also that you were talking about the when there's a stronger emotion involved, there seems to be a distortion in the force that causes things to happen differently, and I think that's an interesting angle on this question, because it addresses one of the questions of why do we do the things that we do, and one of the answers for that is that we have perspectives that see the world in a particular way, and from that perspective we have an emotional response, or to that perspective we have an emotional response. We see the facts of our world filtered through that perspective, that gives rise to an emotional response, and that emotional response drives activity. Now, I would suggest or can offer for consideration that process is not always a process that people are aware of. In fact, that process goes on for the most part for most people at a level where we're not conscious of it. We see the things we see, we're not simultaneously aware of the arbitrary nature of the filter that we're using in order to interpret events, and consequently the responses that we have, the emotional responses we have, are feel like they're objective responses to what's happening in the world, when in fact they reflect a kind of a disposition. So the interesting question was
either reactivity.
Yeah, reactivity. And you see that, I mean, the simple example is, since there's a political debate tonight, you see that in the political arena in spades, because you have a very polarized country with very strong points of view that give rise to very strong emotions, and then people react in accordance to those emotions, and their actions feel like they're rational responses to the way things are, whereas the other side thinks they're just crazy. And it doesn't matter which side you're talking about. The other side thinks the other side's crazy, but it's a consequence of this same phenomenon that we're talking about.
So I want to introduce the perspective of some of the of many spiritual teachers and mystics, and just because I'm familiar with his work, I'll focus for a moment on George Gurdjieff. A century ago, he was outraging cultured and elite Europeans and Americans by asserting just the sort of thing that Stuart's pointing to here, that these masters of the universe, as they thought themselves to be, were actually automatons. That is, that they didn't know, they didn't really understand why they were doing the things that they were doing. They told themselves the story that they were the captains of their souls, masters of their fate, and in fact, masters of the fate of the whole planet. But Gurdjieff forcefully, for decades, was making the point that they were laboring under illusions about that autonomy, and that capacity to act with this thing we call free will. So Stuart has nicely laid a foundation for questioning what free will really means, and in terms of this modern research. But I want to point out that this is a question that has been raised for centuries, if not longer, and so where illusion and something more than illusion intersect is another way to think about what we're trying to pinpoint here. The data that Stuart's pointing to helps us in our modern world because none of us question the validity of these studies. You know, in other words, there are people. Well, I shouldn't say none of us. This is Sebastopol, after all. I beg your pardon on that one. But generally speaking, most people today want some kind of evidence, and when we don't want evidence, there's the place to look at. If we're not willing to look at evidence, can we even talk about free will in that situation? Does it even make sense? Because won't we then be simply insinuated within these processes to which we have little, or about which, and for which, and of which we have little awareness? So that becomes part of the question too, is where does our awareness come? Stuart's pointing to, you know, this evidence that refers to physiological action of the body, and then the relationship of our internal sense of how we might or might not have authorship of what the body's doing. I can certainly say that there are plenty of times when my body has done things when I had no conscious intention that I was aware of to create that sort of thing. And yet, I think we all have had that sort of thing. And yet, most of the time, we don't operate that way. We in fact are expected to take responsibility for what our bodies do, create, and experience. But I also want to point out that one of the words I put into this description for the talk tonight is not just actions, but it's perceptions. So even at the level of perceptions, even at the level of what we're aware of, we may not have the full story. In fact, Stuart was essentially speaking to that a moment ago when he was talking about the perceptions about political ideas and political actions. But I'm saying that's it's true at lower level phenomena. It's true for lower level phenomena in our life too. Is that we may not even have as much quote control unquote or free will about what we perceive, about the basics of what we perceive. So that's another element that I want to introduce here, and it's important because of course one of the, if you will, antidotes that people like Gurdjieff and spiritual teachers have prescribed throughout the ages has been awareness cultivation exercises to help us get or to help us cultivate develop the possibility of attuning ourselves to some of these processes. So I'll let you jump in here.
Well, first, are there questions or comments at this point before we...
Do you want some more tea?
Yeah.
Well, I've done a practice before of just observing, trying to get the mind quiet.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting. The mind just, you know...
Does it?
I'm sure a lot of people here have meditated and seen all the crazy things that come into your mind, but I have gotten the feeling that these are, I can't really say these are coming from me, that they're just events that are happening. They're kind of connected based upon, well, this thought came about because of that thought.
Mm-hmm.
There's this chain going back there, all because, So, you want to comment on the kinds of, on what you may have done more work on that than I have. What do you get to when you get to the bottom of it?
Well, that's a great question, and Rob was sort of setting that up by talking about how different spiritual practices will look at that phenomena in various ways. In the in our own practice, which resembles the Gurdjieff practice, there's a practice of self-observation that creates a space or a perspective in which one can see the arising of thought. But also in that tradition, there's a notion of it's not just the thoughts, it's also the feelings that arise, and it's the sensations in the body. And in this tradition, there's a kind of a notion that we have three brains that are sort of, you know, you think your thoughts are doing, you know, kind of a mixed jumble that kind of keeps going. Well, so are our feelings, and so are our sensations in our body. And the idea with the self-observation, at least in part, in the beginning, is to begin to see the process by which thoughts cause other thoughts, cause feelings, which cause more thoughts, which cause body responses, and to begin to experience the phenomenology of our lives on the inside and see the degree to which we are in reaction to what's going on outside and how our experience is triggered, our ongoing experience is completely triggered by events outside of ourselves. So in other words, the intent of the meditation is to, over time, to get a deeper sense of the distinction between a state of consciousness in which we are in reaction to things outside of ourselves, in other words, just kind of running blindly in reaction, versus a state of consciousness where something else might be going on, where maybe there's a still space of presence that can be present to what's happening but have space before reaction arises. Does that make sense? Now, what do you do with that? I mean, so what I'm describing is a possibility that it might be possible to cultivate or experience a state of awareness which is not always in reaction to interior and exterior phenomena. So let's sit with that for a moment. I would claim that that would be, you know, in terms of answering your, you know, the question of what does one do with that, that becomes the starting point for a deeper inquiry into the nature of one's being. Because then there's a space in which, a space of silence in which one can, you might say, penetrate the silence more deeply. But in the ordinary mode of consciousness that most people function in most of the day, the self-observation helps to begin to see that all of the stuff that's going on, actually what we think of as, you know, us acting as a sort of autonomous agent in the world is largely, not exclusively, but largely in reaction to unconscious processes and unexamined predispositions that are ingrained emotionally, physically, and intellectually into our system.
Yeah. So to give an example of how that can work, I don't know if you. I mean, sometimes we see in literature or spiritual literature, but not necessarily that. We see mention of how people have habits of disposing of their bodies in certain ways. So, for example, we have a couple books in this store. At least, actually, one of them may be out of, because I think it's out of print. But there's this one where there this disciple of Gurdjieff, Madame de Saltzman, is reported to the age of 102 to have been of the habit, but this was a habit that she created in her practice, of sitting as erect in whatever chair she was sitting in as possible, as opposed to the way that when I was a teenager, you know, I'd be sort of like that, watching TV, that, you know. And I know I might walk around, you know, my yoga teacher tells me, you know, that I have had the habit, and I think he's right, of walking with my head forward a little bit like this, as opposed to like that, where there's more of an erect line, I mean, a straight line, down through the top of my skull.
And just as a footnote, as you say that, everyone's sort of starting to sit up more straight. And then the thing to observe is, the interesting thing is when that all relaxes again.
Right. And that's part of the point. The other point is Gurdjieff, you know, famously in some of his writings, he points out that people from different cultures have entirely different body postures.
Mm-hmm.
Entirely different body postures. And you don't have to be a student of this to note it. If you go to a dramatically foreign country, that's simply the case. So these habits we're suggesting, you know, implicit what Stuart just said a moment ago, is the suggestion that it's not just our bodies that we hold and dispose of in particular ways when we're walking, when we're sitting, when we're talking, when we're eating, when we're standing, when we're running, but it's also our emotions, and it's also our mental experience, that we have habits that are just as notable if we put attention on them in the mental realm and the emotional realm.
And the habits are all intertwined. I mean, the habits of mind and the habits of feeling and the habits of body are all interwoven, so that the posture we have is in response to a feeling state we have in the world, which is can get articulated in the inner dialogue of the inner narrative of how we interpret what's happening in the world. And without any examination of that process, we will, by the nature of the egoic mechanism, assume that we're autonomous and objective creatures, when in fact the whole state of being of that consciousness that's making that assumption is in complete reaction to all these unconscious phenomena that's going
processes
that are going on that have, you know, causes and conditions. You know, they may be causes from experiences we had in childhood. They may be just something about our natural disposition. Maybe it's karma from other realms of existence. It doesn't particularly matter where the causes come from, but unexamined, they determine the course of our trajectory, our conscious trajectory, and all the while, when unexamined, we live the illusion of authorship. And that was the challenge that Gurdjieff threw out. It's not unlike the challenge that was a challenge he threw out at a psychological level. Today there's a challenge at a physiological level with the scientific studies, but it's really the same kind of question. And the interesting question in this is, you know, if we, at least for purposes of this discussion, start to look at what we take to be our consciousness as being something that's more determined by unconscious processes, then what can we do about that? Is it even possible to, the way we've mapped this out, to even have any sense of responsibility or authorship or
is it just existential despair? I mean, you can tell by the way I said that I don't believe that. I don't accept that. And yet, plenty of... I actually think that that's the basis upon which many very talented writers and artists have created visions of the world and of human possibility around a kind of despair at this question, because they see all this unconscious behavior enacted around them and they respond to it because in the ways they respond with despair, because they cannot see a way out. There is no magic bullet to this. What makes me not see it that way is the experience of maintaining the question of, do I have free will in this moment? That's one way to phrase it. That isn't the way I usually phrase it, if I phrase it at all. But this meditative practice, for instance, that Stuart was talking about, this self-observation practice, is something that I've engaged in for, you know, a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have evidence of all of a continent of automaticities of my own experience and participation.
Automaticity.
It's a good word.
Ding, ding, ding.
Unfortunately, spell checkers automatically find fault with it.
Yeah.
You have to add it in. But
how does that support you not?
Well, I didn't finish because in addition to that, there are moments when that is not what appears to be arising, and in those moments, it seems to me as if the universe, you know, if I look back on it and create a story around it, one easy story to create is, wow, the universe really co-created this with me to create this incredibly beautiful, unexpected moment.
Mm-hmm.
I just had to write we have this radio show, and I was, I'm constantly writing people to get them on the radio shows. It's usually spiritual authors, and I was doing two different emails last night. One was to Stephen Batchelor, who looks like we are going to have on our show, which is nice because he's a big name. It's good to have big names, get more publicity for the show. And another one was a set of three friends of ours from a spiritual community in Arizona. And I was describing the show to them, and I said something like, you know, we like to create a comfortable conversational space so that people can reflect on their own spiritual practices and ideas. And we try to ask deep questions to stimulate deeper reflection. But then I also said something like, and we also try to create a space where eruptions happen and something new comes into the conversation that we couldn't have anticipated, that none of us could have anticipated. That's the kind of moment that...
a moment of genuine creativity.
Yeah, genuine creativity that I don't take responsibility for in the same way that our narratives of being captains of our fate and masters of the universe would suggest. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a good catch there, that it's the moments of spontaneity or the moments of creativity that aren't predicted.
Yeah.
And when we have those experiences, that gives us a direct encounter with a knowing that something else is possible. And that's why that would be a source of alleviation of despair.
Or a
real surprise.
Yeah, a real surprise,
yeah.
Which is fun, you know.
Yeah.
It's like laughter, creativity. You know, sometimes these things.
Sometimes, you know, like in these conversations, I'll discover something that completely floors me that I just didn't get before, and that's like totally wonderful, because I wasn't looking for that. I wasn't looking to have an insight. You know, we had a conversation with I'm forgetting his name, John Wellwood. John Wellwood, a Tibetan practitioner, a psychologist, and he was talking about the famous term that he came up with, spiritual bypass.
Oh, yeah.
And so spiritual bypass, as you may know, is this idea that we're going to go for the gusto of transcendence and ignore all the problems of, you know, I can't get along with my mother, and my kids hate me, or you know, I can't make a living, or whatever, you know, blah blah blah. But I'm going to go for the transcendent experience, right? And so that process he called spiritual bypass. And in the course of our conversation, it became clear he was a student of Chögyam Trungpa's. It became clear that his experience of spiritual practice and mine were so very different that's why I hadn't understood I hadn't really at a gut level intellectually understood the idea, but I hadn't understood it on a gut level because our experience with our teacher was so totally different. You know, for the first 9 months I was around him 24 hours a day. I didn't have a place to hide to imagine myself transcending to. Except insofar as those moments when I really did transcend what I was normally automatically inclined to do. So in that conversation with John Wellwood, boom, there I was. And I was like, wow, that's the difference. We just had this different background. That was an eruption in that conversation for me. And that's you know, that's the sort of thing that I'm very grateful for. I also wanted to say, you know, apropos of this and this point, that eruptions like that, eruptions of the real in conversation or whatever context, can generally only happen when we're not operating out of contraction and fear. So one of the things I spent the first decades of my spiritual practice doing was letting go of the incredible contraction and fear that I, you know, had operated under for so many decades. That was, you know, now along the way there would be these moments, but coming to a place where we can be more. We're getting some light over there from
the blue light special.
Yeah, it's the blue and red light special coming from that window and bouncing off that window.
It's all
over
there.
Oh, cool. You get it as purple, yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah, I just get the blue because it's red light.
I can see blue and red.
See, we all have different perspectives.
Exactly. Exactly. It's an unexpected moment. Anyway, you know, so these automatic processes are also relevant at the emotional level, because if we're in the habit of being in a contracted place emotionally, operating out of fear, making ourselves small, this is me I'm talking about here, then it's a lot harder for us to make the space for an eruption to happen.
So Jim has a question.
Sir?
I just wanted to tell a story.
Please do.
To illustrate. My teacher was a Korean Zen master, and I was with him in Los Angeles, and he liked to watch the Greyhound races on TV.
They always ask like that.
So,
He was a real Zen master, too, yes, let me tell you.
So I was with him, and we were watching, and, you know, they let the mechanical rabbit, you know, like, go, and then the dogs go after the rabbit. Right? And one of the dogs, about halfway through, stopped, turned around, and went back and got the rabbit by going the opposite way. They said that they had never seen that. It had never happened before. No other dog had done that. You know, because dogs are pack animals. So you have this pack, you know, like barreling down, you know, racing for this rabbit. And Samson was thrilled. He considered that like
Bodhisattva
dog, you know, canine, you know, freedom, you know, like, and he used that story for, I think, you know, like 6 months afterwards. You must be like that dog. you know, like, turn your mind around like that.
Yeah,
so
that's wonderful.
I just thought that story came to my mind as you were talking about habits,
mm-hmm.
and the habit forces and how we know. You know, that there's an experience, a dimension of freedom that, I mean, we can delude ourselves into thinking that we're acting free.
Absolutely.
And I think that sometimes other people see that freedom before we realize that we're acting in freedom.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like...
wanted to share that story.
Thank you.
It makes me think of Stuart's thing about the... You know, the physiological response happening before the awareness in our brains of an action taking place a little bit.
Yeah. There's another aspect of this question of free will that I want to throw out for consideration, because we've laid out this picture that from an ordinary consciousness point of view, our day-to-day consciousness point of view, an argument can be made, and we can do the research ourselves through meditative processes, that much of what we take to be our state of awareness is completely constructed or determined by unconscious processes. And then you ask the question, well, why wouldn't you feel despair about this? And I will submit that there's a claim we can also investigate, that we do have one freedom. You know, we may be these very complex puppets that have been created, and that there's any myriad of levels of hierarchies of activities that give rise to this complex manifestation of a conscious experience, a physical body, and things like that. But it may be the case that the one freedom we actually have is the freedom of where we point our attention. And you know, And it's an interesting, to me, I find that an interesting thesis, because where I point my attention, if I exercise that freedom, I don't have to exercise that freedom. If I exercise that freedom, then that's the beginning of actually being able to be responsible. but it's not a direct process. So although it's not the case, you know, I would claim that, you know, that it may not be the case that we ever can truly, you know, think a thought and do something directly, and it truly be, you know, like we're in control. It may be that through the directing of attention, we can change the dispositions in ourselves such that statistically we begin to act more consistently in certain directions. Hmm. And so in other words, maybe everything I do is the roll of a dice, you know, that but the dice may be weighted in particular ways, and so certain numbers will come up more likely than other numbers. And so every action, every moment is like a roll of the dice. So 80% of the time, maybe I do some constructive things, and maybe 10% of the time I do some destructive things. Your numbers may vary. But it's interesting because it does this idea sort of reconciles the paradox of, well, we don't have free will, but are we responsible? Like, are we morally responsible for ourselves? And it may be that the attention is the bridge there. If I don't turn attention, or if my attention is turned to a certain kind of thought and a certain kind of feeling, then I will consistently recreate the experience of that thought and that feeling. And this is what we see in the world around us. This is what we see in the political world today, because there's a lot of anger and resentment and things like that, and certainly American political society right now, because there are people who are just kind of reinforcing a certain kind of viewpoint and creating this consistent reality that's completely consistent with where they're putting their attention. If you turn your attention somewhere else, then things will start to happen differently. It doesn't happen all at once, because there's a lot of inertia from our habits and tendencies. So, for instance, the way to look at spiritual practice is when you start to turn attention just on the nature of these processes, then we are already starting to create a change in the disposition that we have, and the change in the viewpoint that we start to replicate in our lives on a consistent basis. And in that way, over time, space can open up in ways that it wasn't available before. The challenge is that if we have the viewpoint that, oh, all I have to do is like switch my attention and then everything's going to be A-okay, will probably result in a reciprocal rejection of that, because that's not the way the universe works. The way our system works is that you start to put attention in a particular direction, and you begin to move in that, things begin to reconfigure in that direction. Our feeling state, our mental state, our physical state will begin to align with that, where that attention is pointing. And it's an interesting idea, because in a way, you could say that we're always a slave to something. We're always a slave to where our attention is directed. So we, in that sense, we're never free, ultimately, but our freedom resides in, we have choice about where we turn our attention. So if you turn your attention to the divine, then the divine will unfold in your life. If you turn your attention to despair, then you will reify despair. And it will be a very consistent experience. So that's something to consider out there, because I think that I find that one a it's important, because this is how we can actually transform. It's the secret to transformation, is moving attention. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes this is expressed in ways like I've heard a teacher now passed away, that a great friend of our schools and a friend of our teachers, Lee Ozawick, talked about spiritual slavery. He's not the only one. I think our teacher's teacher, E.J. Gold, talked about spiritual slavery. But, you know, the idea of being a slave of God is, in a sense, another way of expressing the practice of turning your attention to the divine, always returning your attention to the divine, you know. And I won't get into what does that mean right now, but I'm just bear with me. But by doing that, we align ourselves in a sense with a will that's outside of ourselves. Similarly, one can turn one's attention to one's conscience and, you know, go more and more refined as to what conscience means. I mean, that's in itself a mouthful, because it can be misunderstood as, you know, opinions. But we often have a deep sort of voiceless experience of a knowing of right and wrong. And when we turn our attention to that, that sensitivity grows, because it's growing, and it's a feeling that emerges. It's a subtle feeling that emerges. But it grows within us when we turn our attention to it. And so this function of attention, our one real freedom, is our freedom to choose to what we are enslaved to.
Yeah.
Is that conscience or consciousness?
I was using the term conscience.
I know you were.
Are you asking, is there a distinction? Or yeah, I in this case, I'm drawing a distinction, because conscience has a feeling of, you might say, there's different ways of putting it, but certainly in our tradition, conscience is a knowing of divine will, if you will. So,
or something bigger than you.
Yeah,
are.
Yeah, and I think, and the point I'm getting to with all of this is the freedom we find is when we surrender to something that's outside of the psychological and the sort of the individuated self. When we're completely enslaved, it's when we're chasing after that illusion that doesn't actually exist, as we've been talking about. The things that exist are things that are bigger than our notion of ourselves, and if we turn our attention there, we can find freedom. And it's a freedom that is a different kind of freedom. You know, the analogy that I love from a musical point of view, since I study a musical instrument, is that you can practice and practice and practice and practice and practice, and one would say, from an ordinary perspective, well, you're not free. You're completely enslaved, because you're confining
wasting
yourself.
All this time.
Yeah, you're wasting all this time, annoying all these people. but basically, you're practicing in a particular frame, and then you play a piece of music, and that piece of music is written down. You know, it's like, well, that's completely constrained. So where's the freedom? And yet, when you're a master, it's not the notes on the page, and it's not the mechanics of making the music that's where the freedom's found. It's in the vehicle of expression and the subtlety of feeling that comes forward in that spontaneous moment of creation, even though it's completely informed by things that have boundaries and stuff like that. And yet within that, there is this spontaneous freedom and this spontaneous expression and beauty that's possible. That to me is genuine freedom. But that freedom comes in being of service to something, mm-hmm. in a way. And being of service and surrendering oneself. And in that surrendering comes a genuine freedom, because it's like that. It's the ultimate freedom is to lose this self that we carry around that causes all this mischief on a day-to-day basis.
Stuart's Shakuhachi teacher, one of the great Shakuhachi players of the world. We did a he and Stuart's ensemble did a benefit performance last month over at the Tibetan Gallery for the Conscious Family Festival project we're doing. And one of my friends, who had been to at least one previous Shakuhachi concert, and had heard Stuart play over the years, and Stuart's quite good, you know, he's quite good. She went to this concert, and Stuart, I think, played his best solo ever.
Oh.
at this concert. And then his teacher at the end did this completely spontaneous expression. I don't know, it lasted 10 minutes or something like that, on the shakuhachi. And after that, this friend came up to me and said, now I get what shakuhachi is about. I didn't get what shakuhachi was about before. But that, and what she was tuning into is what Stuart's pointing to, what he was able to manifest, and even more so, what this, he's not just a great performer, he's also an incredibly subtle researcher into the production of feeling manifestation through the body expressed in music. It's really incredible.
Actually, as a student of that method, a lot of it has to do with putting attention on the body, on things that we normally don't put attention on, and by doing that, suddenly the body becomes this vehicle for the conveyance of a quality of energy and a quality of sound, which it wasn't before, which is a reason why, you know, I go back to this thing of attention, and where you put attention has a creative effect in the in our ability to be a conveyance or a receptacle for qualities of energy that are beyond anything our small consciousness can dream up. And that the discipline and the service and the gateway to freedom is our willingness to get out of that way and make room for something bigger than ourselves.
So, two questions.
The freedom to choose what we give our attention to is simply the freedom to choose our school, because our attention is what educates us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I want to say. You're just choosing your school.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of metaphors for that. I like that one. I have a work in the electronics world, you know, it's like what you tune into, what your antennas mm-hmm. tune to, mm-hmm. what do you pick up in this given moment. We have lots of wavelengths we can tune into.
And when you find your school, it's an exciting moment.
Thank you.
Yes.
I'll just keep being reminded of this quote that I'm going to totally annihilate about you can't become enlightened by meditating, but yet you won't get there without meditating. Something like that.
Yeah, there's a.
You have to meditate too.
There's a similar one. You can't make lightning strike you, but you can go to the top of the mountain and meditate up there, if you will.
You can take a lightning rod to the top of a mountain during a thunderstorm,
right.
And increase your chances.
Right.
And that's not unlike what we were saying before about the mm-hmm. nature of how things operate for us. You know, how every moment's the roll of a dice, and you know, our particular state gives rise to action and expression and activity, and we may not have direct control over that process directly, but we can change the likelihood of certain kinds of expressions and activities and directions arising. Just, you know, to go back to my musical example, it's like I can't guarantee that I'll be able to play like what Rob was describing, the best solo that I've ever played, but by creating a certain mm-hmm. kind of habit, I can make it more likely that will happen.
So I hadn't tuned into the subtitle of our talk, The Dance of Free Will. The Dance of Free Will. for. But I'm sort of based on this discussion that has emerged tonight. I'm realizing that the dance is a dance between these two concepts, which we collapse, free will as one thing, but really freedom and will are something that it is useful to distinguish in a certain sense and interrogate. What is will and what is freedom, and how is it meaningful to actually put them together? In what ways do they come together meaningfully, and in what ways do they come together and only just lock us into something that doesn't feed where we want to go, or what feels a generous way to go? Because when we're generous with our attention, you know, Stuart, I happen to agree with Stuart's formulation that we do have the capacity to direct our attention most of the time. I mean, some of the great pieces of literature have come out of people in concentration camps or describing their response to the incredible absence of freedom, mm-hmm. and how they were able to direct their attention in a way to the freedom that they could enact in their experience within those contexts. So if that can happen there, it can happen in our lives. It can happen in our daily lives. That's something to leave us with. And I don't know if you have any final capstone.
My teacher Gangaji always uses the word choicelessness.
Boy, I need a choice to make a mess.
And I don't know what it means, if there is a meaning, but she always uses that word, choicelessness. Mm-hmm. And I think it's sort of what you're talking about.
Well, my
it's
teacher...
It's not the absence of choice. It's the flowing of...
Well, it's like the universe... It seems to me that the universe generally knows what... knows the path for us to follow of least resistance to its will, and then sometimes most resistance to my will, or to my inclination, to my habit inclinations. And so part of spiritual practice is actually retraining my habit inclinations to be open to that choicelessness that you're speaking of.
Yeah, I'm reminded, we've been talking to Jim recently about the famous Zen writing, the Shinshin Ming, Jim has a translation of it which begins, "The great way has no obstacles for those who do not pick and choose."
What is it?
The great way has no obstacles for those who do not pick and choose. And so that's how, in the context of, that's how I understand choicelessness in that context, is that it's the cessation of the, you know, picking and choosing from our experience. It's another way of saying yes to whatever arises, which in the context of the freedom of attention and the free will we were talking about earlier, it's the willingness or the ability to... move our attention away from the particular, the thing that may annoy us, or the thing that at one level we may not like, and return our attention to a totality or a completeness, and in that way embrace everything that's happening as a one movement in the mind of God, if you will. And that way, by not picking and choosing...
Is that a bowel movement in the mind of God?
Yeah. B-A-U-L. A bowel. Raoul movement.
That's a joke because our friends who are coming to visit us next week are in the Baul tradition.
The Baul Sufi tradition.
Anyway. Sorry, you have to be in on the little that's bathroom, a very esoteric
little
joke.
Bathroom spiritual humor too. I'm ready right now to talk. Yes.
I belong to a Zendo out of Occidental, and every Monday night we read the Heart Sutra. And I find an incredible absence of Katie Remley when we read that. And it's a field with no's. It's no heart, no voice, no head, no eyes, no nose, no this, no that, no consciousness, no attainment, no thought of attainment. It's a series of no's.
Yeah.
And in the end, the no's, there's this great freedom, and because it's an absence of preference, choicelessness, because there's nothing to choose. And this sounds negative, saying that all is delusion, but in fact, it's a great, wide open field if you can just step into emptiness.
Got it.
Yeah.
Yeah, my teacher's teacher used to say, everything is, answer this question, everything is empty except fill in the blank.
Yeah. All phenomena is illusion
except
the phenomenal fact quiz, all phenomena is illusion except television, cigarette, coffee, yeah.
Right, exactly.
Television.
And there's where
chocolate.
And there's where we need to put our attention. All right, chocolate, indeed.
Can you come off this relationship?
Sure, go ahead.
Very quickly. Change is imminent. Welcome the imminent. Consort with it as though it were your nearest friend. Nothing is closer to us than the moment of unavoidable experience, and in consorting, nothing teaches better.
Yeah, I think that relates. It's sort of an interesting, what comes up for me is, if you, in the same way you can say you put your attention on emptiness, you could be put your attention on change. And embrace the unavoidableness of change, because that's
choicelessness.
Yeah. The choicelessness of change.
Exactly. Well, I think that pretty much does it as far as I'm concerned. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
This has been fun.
Thank you.
So, what next? We meet and continue our discussions and meditations around this on Tuesday evenings here at 7:30.
Yeah, so we have we do meditation and discussion 7:30 to about 9.
Right. And Jim has used his splendid judgment to put out books that may be of interest over there for you to peruse on the way out.
One of which
the least
expensive on the table
least expensive
is The Way of Tayu, which is was written by our teacher. It's a very succinct expression.
Who's your teacher?
Robert Daniel Innes. So you can see his picture in the back of the bookstore. He died in 1998, but he founded Tayu Meditation Center, which is the owner of Many Rivers Books and Tea.
Uh-huh.
Founded it in 1976.
Right.
So the little book, The Way of Tayu, just is something that, his expression, and there's describes some of the language we use, some of the ideas of self-observation, practice we call co-meditation, which we do on Tuesday evenings, which is a two-person meditation form, and there's exercises in the back and all sorts of fun stuff.
We
do co-meditation.
Dyad. Right. Yeah, it's a form that Robert developed. It's there are analogous forms in some other. I've heard the Tibetans do it. I don't see it very commonly, but it's a.
But there are. I mean, we're told because we do it, and then people come and visit and say they'll say, "Oh yeah, I did this that so and so."
Well, sometimes people do it briefly. We do it as a meditation form, and we have different forms of it, but it's a central part of our own practice.
Is there an inquiry with it?
Not in the basic form.
Not in the basic form, but in a lot of extended forms, yes.
There are forms where there is an inquiry, and there's sort of ways of training, you know, people to hold a space for inquiry and things like that that are related.
In other words, because it's two people beyond the basic form, one person can be get practice being a witness to mm-hmm. the other person, mm-hmm. and in a way that we don't generally do. Mm-hmm. You know. So and then the other person gets to hold the inquiry themselves and then explore that in conversation in some of the forms.
Mm-hmm. Is there a chosen pre-chosen topic on Tuesdays, or just something arises?
Often it's something arises. We don't come in with a list of topics so much as open up for
questions.
Although
I did come in with a quote last Tuesday, which was unusual, but
yeah.
I did. But it was just a thing to talk about for a while, along with the other things.
Mm-hmm.
What was the quote?
Mm-hmm.
I don't have it with me, but it was from Adam Gopnik, a New Yorker writer, who wrote a piece on Henry James. Henry James, I didn't know this, the writer Henry James in the 19th century was the brother of the famous William James. I didn't know that. And so he was writing a piece about Henry James's two autobiographical books about growing up with William James. And the quote was something about a very American form of spirituality where, let's see if I can reconstruct this, where you can have as much transcendence and expansiveness of heart as you wish, as long as you show up for that. In a way, it's sort of not unlike some of the stuff that was coming up tonight in tonight's discussion, because he was talking about you by showing up. I took him to mean you're putting attention on your life.
But that's what we talked about. What does showing up mean?
Right.
That was the topic.
So, anyway, thank you. There's a donation bowl over there as well.
Okay.
And that was fun.
Yeah.